Okay, so let's go for 9. So this is just an update for Ant 9. So we have put dates and location and the names. We are currently assembling the program committee, so there will be more news on that later. And we hope to have the first call for papers before summer. And you have to anticipate something like mid-January for sending us your papers. And that's it for the announcement. Thank you.
All right. So, not that we need to make the introduction, but our next speaker is Chris Lamoran. He's going to talk to us about advances in the method for prolific curves.
Okay, thank you. So I have many people to thank, all my sponsors here. And I am enjoying my sabbatical in Waterloo, so that's quite fun. It's quite a good period to clean up desks here and there, as we were discussing with Renato yesterday. So it's a good time to think about doing something else but than administrative duties and going back to algorithmic number theory and things like this. So I'm pretty happy to be there also, and that's okay. And I also to thank all the preceding speakers who spoke about CM, because now I just have to concentrate on my part and forget about everything else. That's good. I try not to be too technical, and that's okay. And as you might see, I will try to have Beamer look like tech for Renio.
You'll make
okay, so let's defreeze maybe this things like this. Okay, so motivation, I will be very brief because you already saw a lot of them. I will try to make definitions of what the CM method is or is not, and insist mostly on replacing this two huge J function by what are called class invariants and small functions if you prefer. And if I have time, I will also comment on another part of the algorithm where there were recent advances. So motivation, suppose I don't want to use Hopf's algorithm for whatever reason, because it's too slow maybe, or it cannot handle large numbers. Then we can use elliptic curves with complex multiplication. And what is very neat is that you have a very easy characterization of what you're looking for. If I can write a prime number as a sum of squares, more or less, then there is somewhere an associated elliptic curve whose cardinality I know is just p plus 1 minus u. And all we want to do is compute more or less the curve here and check that these are okay. So this building block, so to speak, was introduced in primality proving, was the heart, is still the heart of primality proving, at least with elliptic curves, around 1986. And then I joined later. And nowadays you see that it's also used as a primitive in this elliptic AKS stuff. Maybe it will work one day. By working, I mean efficiently. So maybe the first attempt of extracting the primitive out of this business was a paper I wrote in 1991 showing that I could build cyclic elliptic curves very easily over a finite field. Application of this is totally useless, but I mean it's kind of extracting it from first context. And nowadays there are many more applications, so I'll be brief on this. Renier already spoke about this problem, and I can refer to the paper on concerning the taxonomy, sorry, of pairing friendly curves, explaining that you need the CM method to be able to compute some small curves, sorry, some curves with small embedding degrees. So really it's a basic task, so to speak, to be able to build elliptic curves having complex multiplication. So just to fix ideas and just to give you the motivation, the original motivation in one slide, primality proving is just what? Enumerate a bunch of curves and wait for the good one to appear. So what does this mean in practice? That's easy. You loop through a set of discriminants of quadratic fields, imaginary quadratic fields, in which your candidate n, which is supposed to be prime, or that we want to prove prime, will split, which can be written like this. And when that happens, then you can compute something that should be the number of points on your curve, if n is prime. And you wait for this guy to factor easily, which means a small cofactor and a large cofactor, which is a probable prime. Then you use the end of the CM method to build E and some other things. And after that, if you can prove that P, a point on E, has a Priskov order, say the order is M, and you just have to prove that N prime is a prime, and you do that recursively. And since N prime is smaller than N, then this process will end at some point. And you have a huge recursive proof, called more or less certificate, for the primality of N. And so there are variants of ECPP. In fact, there's no canonical definition because it's parametrized by the choice of this set of discriminants and by many other parameters on the way. And if you do that in a certain way, you can obtain a complexity that maybe one day will be proven to be this, meaning that since we depend on conjectures of in analytic number theory, you can just wait for some 100 years before having the answer. Anyway, it works in practice with that complexity, more or less, and the record is still at 20,000 decimal digits. So let's maybe freeze this and advance. So preparing this talk, and I already gave part of it in Redmond 2 weeks ago, but it has some parts have changed. So I tried to identify now what are the different contexts in which the CM method appears. And it seems to me that there are at least two different ways to use it. So the original one is primality proving then, and there we deal with large prime numbers or large probable primes. So this has nothing to do with what I would call small sizes of crypto. And there are, you see, not only is crypto in crypto the case that P is known to be prime, but P is small. And here in ECPP, it's a probable prime and it's large. So I decided that large means 30,000 bits. So here, since we don't know that N is prime, we have to be careful here and there. It's not really a problem. Difference is that maybe in primality proving, we have a lot of these that we can try. And in CM, maybe not. Sometimes, for instance, if you come from a pairing-friendly construction, you have one D. This is the one you have to build a curve for. And perhaps it has some distinctive property, like I insist only on D being 5.8, and maybe there are no points of order 4. And other differences, maybe I know that the cardinality is a prime, which is not the case in primality proving here. And so that can speed up things here and there. Here, I don't care about D. I can take any D. I'm very happy with 3 dividing D for reasons I will explain later on. How can I prove that my cardinality is okay? And then, in fact, the process of the algorithm gives you the proof at the end. I mean, I end up with a huge certificate, and every part finally proves something about one curve, or all the curves in the certificate. And we were discussing this with Dan Bernstein here, and yesterday, sorry, and he told me that there are many verifications of certificates in crypto. That might be the case. For primality proving, I'm afraid not. Maybe I'm the only one to check my own certificate. Despite the fact they are on the web and the format is known and so on and so on. And so maybe you see, you can now realize that maybe algorithms that will be used at some point, even if you don't know what they are, they will tend to differ at some point. Okay? Maybe if I know that I will spend 1 billion, that I will have 1 billion verifications to do, this is not the same thing as optimizing for one certificate in primality. The only common point between these two contexts, except mathematics and so on, is the case that we have to handle large Ds, large class numbers, they will appear somewhere, maybe both at the same time. And large means something that depends on the use, the size of N here, size of D, etc. We Andrew yesterday told us about this example of degree 10 embedding for pairing friendly curves, for which the least D is something like 10 to the 9th, you said, something like this. So you immediately see that there's a problem of complexity waiting here. So, okay. So now I will try to define the CM method. You already saw theorems in the preceding talk. So just to fix the idea, sorry, M is, I don't have that many letters. Same problem again. So the basic theorem is this one. P can be written, a prime number P can be written as more or less sum of two squares, if and only if it fits in the ring flat field KD of the imaginary quadratic field K of discriminant D. And how do you realize this in a mathematical way? That's easy, you take the modular invariant J, it has this Q expansion, and you plug in it the value M omega being a generator of the ring of integers of your quadratic field. So if you want to stick to a small example, you take D equal minus 4, the quadratic field is Q of I, the ring of integers is generated by I, class number is 1, class group is trivial, and you will have a theorem telling you when it splits and so on. There's a third button missing, like every time shift on, freeze on the left. Anyway, that's good. Okay, so what's the algebraic theory? How do you compute how do you realize or construct whatever this field here, KD? And in fact, you enumerate your class group here. You know by theory that the extension KD over K is Galois, and it has this as Galois group. The degree of the extension is the class number, so the cardinality of this guy. And the minimal polynomial, you can take it to be the product of A, X minus G, J of I, where J is the function, and you have a way to go from class group, from members of the class group here to complex number, quadratic complex number, to J. And again, it has already been said by Reynier, you'll find some polynomial here with integer coefficients. And if you glue everything together, you have this the fundamental theorem here, which tells you that 4p splits like this, if and only if d is the square mod p, and your polynomial hd of x has exactly h root mod p. And so if you know how to do that, then again, you will have an elliptic curve with cardinality p plus 1 minus u. So just to go back to my easy example of q of I, you have writing like this for p, if and only if p is 2 or p is congruent to 1 mod 4, because in that case, the class number is 1, so that polynomial here has degree 1 in z, so it always splits, okay? And you have the answer. So of course, this is like summarizing, 100 years of mathematics in two slides. So there are here some references. The book by Cox is the most recent one. And you can also look at this old lecture notes in math, which contains at least a classical theory of why all this is true. So I will just now make some algorithms out of this. So just to fix ideas maybe, if I want to compute class fields here, I can just do my method here for enumerating the class group and so on. So you see you have degree 1 polynomials very easily here, and you have these big numbers and these big class polynomials, always to frighten your small kids and so on and so on. So if my kids were young enough to be frightened by this, it would be okay, but still too late. Anyway, so you have bigger coefficients here and you want to do something smaller, so to speak. Okay, so now defining the CM method once I've given the theorem. Didn't I say freeze at some point? Okay then, So what's the input of the method? Finite field, say okay, P, large prime. Discriminant here, it can be fundamental or not, don't care. U and V, such that this writing is correct. And maybe I want a curve whose cardinality is P plus 1 minus U. And maybe I want a proof that this is correct. So here are some comments. I did U and V in the input because for CM crypto, this is more or less what happens. More or less. I mean, at least in the pairing friendly stuff, generally speaking, you come with U and V at the same time. So, okay. If you don't have U and V, that's not a problem because you can use Kornacki's algorithm, for instance, and you have U and V. Proof of correctness, okay, everything we do is bug-free. That's well known. In any case, we have to prove something sometimes. So it's the same method if your curve has cyclic cardinality because it's prime, for instance. That's easier. Okay, for primality proving, as I told you, the proof comes from the remaining part of the algorithm. Otherwise, maybe we'll have to factor P plus 1 minus U, exhibit one or two generators of your curve, prove that your two generators are independent, things like this. So that's doable. That's a bit tedious, but that's doable. And if you are not in any of the two contexts, like primality proving or CM, for instance, if you cannot factor this guy here, M, then you have no proof. So if proof is important, then some cases cannot be done because it depends on factoring. And factoring is still not that easy. Okay, so let's say that's the first method. So it's not very precise because you see here you could end up with some curve which happens to have the right number of points by luck or by accident or whatever. If you want to be very rigorous, you have to say, okay, I want a curve having in fact CM by the order of discriminant D. So maybe it's too much what I ask. Maybe nobody cares about this. It's like, I mean, you have to be careful at some points maybe. And here, if you want a proof of correctness of this, then you will enter again the volcano business. And if you cannot factor M, or if your discriminant is very much not non-fundamental, so to speak, you could end up with some troubles. But in the two contexts I gave you, that's more or less okay. But we could be very precise here. So let's say that the CM method is one of these. In any case, at the end of the algorithm, you will end up with a curve E having this cardinality. So maybe this is the only thing you care about. And that's okay. So, now time for algorithms. So, how does it work? So, you already saw that polynomial. Basically, you have to compute this polynomial, find the root of it mod P. Any root will give you an invariant, and from the invariant, it's easy, more or less, to go to an equation for your curve. And after that, you have to perform some exponentials, some multiplication of points on the curve, and this is it. So of course, not all these phases have the same complexities or difficulties or whatever. And so this is where we start to see a difference between Peck and Beamer, like this. Okay? We cannot do that in plain text. Maybe I don't need to do that, but that's convenient. Okay, so computing HD, I don't have to tell you much more about it because we already had two talks on this. So there are three methods, complex, periodic, and CRT. The fastest one seems to be CRT, and I will comment on this later about invariants and so on. Second part, finding a root of a polynomial mod P. That's a well-known problem, and there are many solutions to do that. And I won't comment on this, except that I spent a lot of time using Galois theory to try to break my tower of extensions into intermediate extensions to reduce the degrees of intermediate polynomials to speed up the thing. Step three, I will come back to it later at the end of my talk with the paper by Rubin and Silverberg. And I will not say many things about step four, except that if you insist, you can use Edwards or Montgomery curves in some cases. I wrote a paper on this, and I don't want to concentrate on this here. So basically, what I would like to do is, in fact, explain how to replace this polynomial here, HD of J, by something smaller. And the rest of the algorithm will be modified slightly. Step two will be modified, and there will be some interesting consequences for step three. Okay, what's the problem? So the problem again is I want to construct this Hilbert class field. And here again, there are two slightly different cases. I might want just a description of the Hilbert class field, which means give me a defining polynomial. Okay? This is a classical algebraic number theory problem. And there's another thing you might want to do is, okay, I will construct KD, but at one point I will have to come back to a curve. So coming back to a curve means that I have to take into account that I need some representation of the modular invariant J as a number in my algebraic number field. Okay, so obviously I can say, okay, I build the number field, and then I take the minimal polynomial of J, and I factor it over my defining polynomial. So if you do that, complexity will tell you that you're crazy. And algorithms to factor over algebraic extensions are not so good. Okay, so that's not the way to go. It's doable, of course, if everybody is small, you can do that. I mean, but it has to be taken into account. So for instance, you take a random polynomial equation at random, like this one, J equal to x plus 16 to the third divided by x, and you solve it for x, and you find an integer, you say, okay, that's good. Okay, but it's not a polynomial at random, of course. And the theory is all there. I mean, J has some bright properties, and one of the most important ones is its role in modular curves, so to speak. So here, in fact, you have a modular curve. It's x0 of 2. It has some properties. I will discuss some of them later. And each time you have a modular curve, you have kind of modular polynomial between x and j. And maybe you can have roots of this equation in the defining in the defining field of j. If you have this, this is a class invariant. Okay? So here you have, you see, multiplication by square root of minus 2. Minus 2, I mean, the quadratic field q of square root of minus 2 as class number 1. So j has to be a rational integer. And you see that the solution here is 64, which is also a rational integer. So it is in the same field as j. Okay? So we want to do the same thing for any class number. So a class invariant is something that generates q of j of alpha, or maybe q of square root of d and j of alpha. Depends a little bit. But, I mean, something that will give us the Hilbert class field and maybe some relation with J. So just for the record, because you already saw these functions, at least function F, you can be more precise here. This modular equation has three solutions in X, and the three solutions are given by these functions, which are called Faber functions, and which are more or less products of and quotients of eta functions, some of which we'll see later on. So just to be able to prepare you to F later. So just something to fix things. Here you consider a modular curve x0 of n with x0 as a subscript or a superscript, whatever. And in fact, functions that interest me here are functions that are invariant by this set here of 2x2 matrices. In the sense that if you apply F to a 2x2 matrix applied to Z, it will be invariant. So there are technical conditions, but we don't care about them. And so each time you have a function like this, there's a modular equation. You take the coset of gamma, which is SL2 of Z, by gamma 0 of n. You have a finite number of cosets. Here, the number is this arithmetical function psi of n. And you have a modular equation, which means that there exists a polynomial phi of depending on f, such that phi f of alpha and j of alpha is 0. And it's called a modular equation. So here you see you have exactly this case for n equal 2, and this is a modular equation for n equal 2. So, please again, what's the relation between this and class invariance? Once you have this modular equation here, and once you know that j of alpha is an algebraic integer, then any root of phi f of x and j of alpha will be algebraic. So the thing is, you want to be to have this number algebraic of the same degree as j, and in fact in the same defining field. But there's no real magic here, okay? You have a polynomial equation here, algebraic number, you get an overall algebraic number. So what do we want? We want a number which is algebraic of the good degree, and we want its conjugate. And to do that, you have to call Shimura's reciprocity law, which tells you that more or less take any function on gamma 0 of n, you will end up with a class invariant. So here again, I put under the carpet many things, but keep in mind that you just have to find functions on modular curves, sorry, functions on subgroups and modular curves, and you have class invariant. And there's also some technicalities here to find all the conjugates at the same time. Because that's okay to know that one algebraic number is algebraic. You want its minimal polynomial. Okay, so a standard answer nowadays that I read in some papers is, okay, I don't care about the conjugates, I just call LLL and I get them. Okay, this is no mathematics, you know. Okay, and this is not an algorithmic up to a certain point. So you have to have a formula and a way of getting all the conjugates at the same time, because if you do that, then you will be able to build, for instance, the minimal polynomial, which is necessary at that point. Okay, so enough theory. We just have to make one more step before giving many examples, like filling the zoo that Renia was referring to previously. So I will introduce some measure of success in replacing j by other functions. You can say, okay, what's the size of j? J, as already mentioned by Renier, is something whose height is proportional to square root of d. And there what I want is compare the size of my new invariance compared to j. And for doing this, that's easy. You use this theorem by Hendry and Silverman, which tells you that if two algebraic numbers are related by a bivariate polynomial, then the height of one divided by the other is proportional to the ratio of the degrees of your function in one variable divided by the other one. And this is the magical constant C of F. It's not a constant, it depends on F, that we want to minimize. So if you come back to this example again here, you see that the magical constant here is 1/3. And so j has constant 1, obviously. We have 1/3 here. We want to do more. If we are able to replace 2 to the power 6 by 2, then I will get 1 over 18. This is what we are looking for. Okay, so what we want is functions f such that this ratio is small. There's one thing we cannot do too much, is that the way I described it, here this degree in x, is always psi of n. And psi of n is that guy here. So it's kind of fixed. So you have an optimization problem where you have this fixed, so you have to have this small, so to speak. Why not? Okay. So what do you do when you want to build modular curves and find functions on subgroups? Then you very often use what is called Newman's lemma. It was given for x0 subscript, but it's the same. Basically, you take Dedekind zeta function here. So I put the product, but there's also a sparse series if you expand it. And you build here a product of these eta functions. With D running through the divisors of N, there's eta of D over D here, and RD is some integer which has to satisfy these conditions. And these are the technical conditions I referred to about the function being invariant for gamma 0 of N and things like this. So that's a very nice approach because it's parameterized. Okay, give me any sequence RD, and I can build a function on gamma 0 of N. And now the game is what? Is to minimize the exponent or the magical constant C of J. Okay, so among all of the families that were considered out of Neumann's family, there are mostly two, even if sometimes they are too restrictive. The what we call the generalized Weber functions, I will spend quite a lot of time on this later, and the Engelschertz family, with all kinds of parameters everywhere. Here, these are prime numbers, P1, etc. And here, we put any n. So the classical results, due to Weber, for instance, are for n equal 2. And, for instance, my function f1 I mentioned previously is just w2. The case of w3 was studied by Ellis G. And there are also some variants of this by Agier and Villegas. And we did mostly study of this whole stuff here. So, I told you that we want to minimize the degree in J of the modular equation. So we have formulas for computing everything, the degree of the modular equation and so on and so on. It takes several pages, so in our preprint. I will just extract some results. And so what's the minimal value of the degree of J? Obviously it's 1. And in fact, it's related to the cases where your modular curve is of genus 0. And so there's a finite list of these, known for quite a long time. And we are using them right now. So you see for all these, you find modular equations and functions that are usable. So here there's a particularly nice case. It's a case where n minus 1 divides 24, then the optimal function, so to speak, is given by a generalized Weber function. And you find small modular polynomials like this. So for the case of 2, there's a magical exponent here that will be used later on. We already saw that one. Okay, it's for n equal 2. For n equal 3, you have this sparse polynomial also. And this is something that is less known, is the case of n equal 4, and you have this equation for the modular curve. And when n minus 1 doesn't divide 24, then you have a list of functions. And I put for each of them their constants here. So you see that we have small constants right now. Okay. So what about generalized Weber? So I spent quite a lot of time on my sabbatical year doing this. You need some prescribed conditions to do that. You need snow. And you need Galois theory. And I don't know which is the more relaxing. I don't know. Anyway. But you need time because there are many cases and we wanted to do all cases. Okay, so at the end of winter, we have all cases where some 24 foot of unity to some power multiplied by Wn to the E is a class invariant. So it will be at least two papers because the first one is without roots of unity and the second with roots of unity. Typical results out of a bunch of results. If n is 5 mod 12 and d is not divisible by 3, then Wn squared is a class invariant. So you see the smaller the power here, the better. So Wn squared is good, in a few words. And you have the same for n is 7 mod 12 and to nd odd. And then if you add up roots of unity, then you have a thinner family of discriminants, but still they exist. And you can find small defining polynomials as this one. Other examples, so looks like G's results I should take it correctly. And you see, I insist on these guys here. For instance, n equal 4, which is rather new in the business. Take any discriminant congruent to 1 mod 8, you can use W4. And W4 is a good invariant, because the constant here is 1 over 48. No restriction on D apart from this. N equal 25, that's also good. You can use it each time D is the square mod 20. Constant is 1 over 30. And a lot more in our paper. So we have formulas for comparing everybody with everybody. So here you see I take a generalized function, a Weber function here, of prime degree. Constant is explicit here. And here I put some explicit constant for square, prime square values. And the last column is the degree in J. So I told you we have to have small degrees in J. There will be another reason for that later, but for to have a small C of F, you have to have a small J. And you see here that the degree tends to increase, of course, with parameters. Now, if you want to compare everybody, because we are in a zoo, so you have to decide who is the lion, so to speak. And so we compare for prescribed values of parameters. So you see if the high score, so this is 1 over C because it takes less space, whatever. So when we did our first inquiry into this with Andreas for ANS 5, we had the black values, so to speak. And with generalized Weber, now we have the blue ones. And you see that we are new champions, so to speak. W4, W9, and powers. And here you might, in fact, ask why I stopped here. In fact, if you look at the formulas here, when L is a prime, then the magical constant tends to 1 over 24. So all primes here, all squares of primes are somewhere here, okay, before that line. Anyway. So most interesting one, 25 again, 29. And this is Newman 18, so this one here with 36. You have Engerschert and so on. You have this Ramanujan T invariant by Constantinou and Kanto-Georgis, and later slightly conditions of use of this slightly improved by Andreas. You can do D congruent 1 mod 12 here. And a new function AC71 I used recently. I found it when preparing this talk. And you see, this is the correct situation right now. And so you see there's somebody in red here. It's 96. And so why is it 96? For this, you have to ask Rainier and Peter. And in fact, when I visited him, Rainier reminded me that they had this conjecture about, I mean, this result on the fact that the minimal value of our magical constant here should be larger than 1 over 96. So I won't tell you where it comes from, but it has something to do with some eigenvalue of some operator. And it's called Selberg's conjecture, and it was rephrased by Avramovich to link this with what is called the gonality of a modular curve. And when you add everything together, then you end up with 1 over 96. And if it's not 1 over 96, it's 1 over 105, something like this. Okay, and you see that we are far away from this. Far away, depends. We are at 72, or 1 over 72. And the question is it possible to have something in between 72 and 96? So when you look at this, the first results are disappointing. And one of the reasons for this is that complexity or asymptotic computations do not make you happy. Why? Because you see, suppose, take this one for instance, suppose I make P1 and P2 go to infinity, then this will converge to 1 over 12. Nothing you can do about it. Here it will be maybe 1 over 24. If you look now at more precise things like what's the genus of x0 of n, it's well known that that genus is approximately psi n over 12. And in fact, the degree of j cannot be smaller than the genus, so to speak. So if you add everything together, then your constant should go, should be approximately 1 over 12. So we cannot have asymptotic luck. Okay, it has to be immediate luck, so to speak. So, okay, you say you don't need gamma 0 of L. Maybe you can quotient by the Alkinenor evolution. You end up on x0 star of L. What happens? What you gain is that your genus is divided by 2. But in fact, at the same time, the degree in J is multiplied by 2. So you still are stuck with 1 over 12. So you have to look at small cases. Small cases is something like, when is this guy, sorry, parenthesis missing. What is this guy, when is this guy of genus 0? And the answer is that for prime L, the largest L is 71. And you end up with 1 over 36 as a constant. And what is good is that the degree in J is 2. Okay, so this is a good function. So maybe the only problem is that you will have to evaluate it. So the best thing to do is to use some theta functions obtained by Atkin. Okay, but it works. You have to be careful, but it works. And you can use it each time d is a square mod 71. Okay, so what next? What next is replace L by N and see what happens. Problem is that there are very few papers on modular curves of composite index, and all the papers I read are, so to speak, incomplete. They should have been submitted to Journal of Irreproducible Results, because there's always something missing. Okay, you have an equation, you don't have the function, or you have the functions, you don't have the equation. So this is why it's written here work in progress. I have to redo all the computations these guys did, and some of them have no emails and no web page. And okay, and the journals are even not on the net because some obscure Japanese journal. And anyway, I mean that's okay. Obviously, I have some time left before I end my vacation sabbatical stuff. So, but I'm not sure that in 2 months I can work this out. And probably it won't work. I mean, you see, I gave you reasons why it should not work. In any case, it has to be tried. Okay. So I will tell you later on what happened. Okay. So these are for, I mean, this guy I did not use yet. I think it's interesting. And I already used the other one. So, okay, we'll see. So how do you use now this invariance? There's a price to pay for using a small invariance. You see, I told you, how do you find the curve? You solve your equation in J, and you find the equation of the curve. And now the situation is a bit indirect, because you have your invariant here, U, say some generalized Weber. You have this class polynomial. You solve it for a root mod p, and then now you need J. And J is the root of your modular polynomial. And maybe the degree in J is not 1. So you have to solve this equation here, this modular equation when you have, where you have substituted x by u0. And maybe there are several roots. Okay, and even if you can have some tricks to discard immediately some bad roots, maybe you have to try all your remaining roots. So it's not a direct link to any ticker. So, but generally speaking, if you take phi of small degree in J, then you will have a small number of J to try, and that will be okay. But still, it's maybe unsatisfactory, particularly in the cases where your finite field is small, and you don't want to spend that much time finding curves. Okay, so you have to balance things. And as a final remark, you don't need modular equations for composite index. Can do some resultant somewhere, and you don't have to store a huge table of modular polynomials. So that's the price to pay, but at least for primality proving, that's doable. Okay, last part, because I want to show you some precise data for real stuff. How do I find the correct equation for the elliptic curve? So there is one answer, that is, I don't care. If it's not the right one, I try to twist. So for a complexity point of view, that's a perfect answer. And that's it. So we can do something more clever to find the cardinality of it. The problem in two words is that any curve with this equation has J as invariant, including the curve which has the curve we are looking for, which has P plus 1 minus U point, and its twist, which is P plus 1 plus U in general. And we would like not to waste 1.5 curves by just trying at random and see if things work. And maybe it's boring to try both curves at the same time. So you will tell me, yeah, that 1.5 is not okay. It's okay, and okay. But then you will skip many interesting mathematics like character sums and things like this. And so since I'm not doing crypto in this talk, maybe you already mentioned that. I should have mentioned that, but probably it's obvious now. So why not? Don't we do BAF? Okay. And so the situation is very complex, so to speak. If there are particular cases, for instance, d equal minus 3 and minus 4, done a long time ago by Gauss. And it took quite a long time to have a very explicit description of all cases for h equal 1. So maybe you remember there are 13 discriminants of class number 1. And to have the answer for these discriminants were a bit tedious, and we have many methods, some of which with one of my co-authors who left already, and so on. So Stark gave the first generic solution to this for d prime to 6. And the problem is that from a computational point of view, this is very hard to use, because you have to play with two invariants at the same time. That's not good. So one of my interests in generalized Weber function was, in fact, replace this by using some small torsion points on CM curves, if they exist. For instance, this is why a case in which I'm very happy to have d, my discriminant divisible by 3, is that in that case, I can use some W3. If I have W3, I can find a 3 torsion point. And then to fix the right sign of the Frobenius, I just have to have an action of compute the action of the Frobenius on the 3 torsion point, and that's pretty easy, and that's it. So you see, this is where you have interference between finding a good invariant and what you do at the end. And there's a new paper by Ruby and Silverberg, who can do all discriminants, maybe with the restriction by D fundamental. And there's just one problem with this approach, is that they need to use as invariants in the preceding phase J or gamma 3, square root of T. And many people know that these are the worst possible invariants. And question, say, okay, if D is small, we don't care. That's easy. If D is large, then you cannot afford generally to use J or this. And can we do something? So I try to use that. And one case which works more or less okay is that one, the case where D is divisible by 4, and D over 4, in absolute value, congruent to 1 mod 4. What they do in their paper is that they insist on having a special factorization of your defining polynomial over Q of square root of D. In classical terms, you would wait, you would anticipate something about Q of square root of D, big D. Not, so big D is negative, and small d is positive, and it's a non-standard way of looking at your class polynomial. In any case, it works in that particular case. And in fact, their method can work with any real invariant. What I call a real invariant is an invariant whose minimal polynomial has integer coefficients. the other ones are integers over k. So, okay. So you can replace, for instance, you can replace j by a Weber function, if it is real. Or what you can do also is you can try to factor your class polynomial over the real genus field, or at least the real part of the genus field of your Hilbert class field. I won't comment on this now. Or you can even do some Galois theory over KG plus. That's doable. That's not easy, but that's doable. Now, question is it worth the trouble? Not sure. But maybe if you pre-compute everything, maybe it's okay. Okay, next one. There are some other cases. I just show them because they lead to non-standard modular equations. So sometimes they insist on using this invariant square root of plus or minus d times gamma 3. And in fact, there are two modular equations you can use instead here. There's modular equations between gamma 3 and w3 to the 6th, and gamma 3 and w7 to squared. So, and after that, you have just to tweak things such that you can write square root of d times gamma 3 as d times something divided by square root of d times this invariant, and we showed with Andreas that this invariant is sometimes real. But you see, it's one case out of 1 million, so that's funny. That's I like these modular equations, and but what's the point? I don't know. And the case where you put a square root of d instead of square root of where you put absolute value here, I don't know. Maybe. But this would need something on understanding what is this invariant correctly, which is far from being obvious. Okay, now you want the real stuff. So obviously I took something which is not CM related, crypto CM, which is benchmarks on 10,000 decimal digit primes. Now we are primes. And you see, primality proving is not a killer application, as you would maybe say. It's impossible to make money out of this, but still there are people who want me to prove primes. At least my machines do that better than I. So. And so, by some coincidence, I did recently three numbers of approximately the same size. So that's what we call benchmarks. Okay. So a long time ago, it was a dream to do that size of number. But when I began, I was very happy to do 1,000, and now it's trivial to do 10,000. So that's okay. That's progress. Who knows? And so these are non-random numbers, but okay, close to. And so it's interesting to see what happens in primality proving in different phases of the algorithm and concentrating maybe on the most CM related stuff. So how long does it take to prove a number like this prime? All timings here are given in day. I didn't tell you, but I mean everything is distributable and parallelizable and whatever. So okay, 2 weeks on my cluster, for instance, of AMD 64, 2.4 gigahertz, if you insist. Okay, so, and you see, there are two phases in ECPP. First one, you find all these discriminants, and then you find all the curves. So, and you see that each time, the first phase dominates the second one. So, and you see by some bizarre thing, the first number here is hard, and the last one is easier. So every algorithm that operates on numbers, integers, has a standard deviation going to infinity. Okay, so this is not a conjecture, this is a well-known theorem. And see, here standard deviation is 2, so to speak, so not so bad. And here I looked at log files because Christine, when I showed that, she told me, why is it so hard? I don't know. I will give you. I mean, I know why. I mean, I know why it took so long time, but I don't know why this number is difficult. Maybe I should do this and have the second one at the same time. So here are more precise timings. You see, the first phase is stops here at PRP. Okay. So you see, for instance, this is the time needed to compute square roots as input to Kornacki's algorithm. So you see, 25 days or 15 days. And you can make this look at this in correlation with Kornacki's time. You see, if you double the time here, then you double the time here. And you also have some problems here in probable prime tests, because it just means that you spent all your time trying to find a new candidate for the next step. That's life. And so if you take more time, then you will consume a lot more discriminants, and you will consume a lot of probable prime tests. So you can say also that primality proving is just slow because we have to do all these probable prime tests, and nobody knows how to do that in a fast way. So you see, and okay, the first probable prime test I use is just Fermat, maybe with some tricks. So what can I do faster? I cannot gain a factor of two here. Well, that's impossible. So okay, so these guys, he required a lot of these and PRP. And the other ones, you see, it's remarkably constant. And which is very strange, because you see distributed computations, not always the same number of processors, and whatever. But it's constant. And here you see the number of steps in my recursive proof. So it's constant also. What should be said then? So this line is for Dan, but we'll see that later. So here I have a stupid problem. I have a large bunch of discriminants. I want to compute their class numbers. I would like to do that in less time than 5 days. So, open question. Kornacki already did a lot of this. FKW is sorting out, extracting small prime factors. Did a lot also. And if you look at the second phase, which is computing class polynomials and finding roots of them, you see that computing class polynomials takes no time. Less than 1 day. So these are my programs with the complex multiplication method and new invariants. So, okay, so it takes no time. Finding roots mod p takes a long time. So I already did a lot about this. Here again, there are not so many methods and tricks that we can use. And you can compare step 1 and step 2, and these are more or less the same numbers here. And you see that there's always a ratio of, say, 3. And now, last thing, if you want to know the time, you need to check the certificate when it's established. And you see, it takes 1 day, less than 1 day. So it tells you something. So coming back to this slide now, you see I added here, large values of D and H I currently encounter when doing primality proving. Okay, so discriminants, class number. So you see, I mean, I have constants in my programs anyway. But you see, I can currently very easily do class numbers like 15,000, something like this, 12,000. And when you add everything, you see it's less than 1 day, so that's okay. And you see here, I put the number of times new invariants are used. I mean, a kind of caching technique for polynomials. Anyway, so these are new polynomials created for this particular primality proof. And you see that top scores were these double eta stuff a long time ago, and now that I introduced W25 and 49 and so on, and N18, then these guys are used a lot. So, one example with N18 is D, that D, which has large class number here, is somewhere here. Okay, so you see more timings. Here I compute the class polynomial and I factor it through the tower of extensions, so it takes less than 3 hours. And the time needed to find roots mod P was quite a lot more. And you have to compare this with the time needed just to perform one exponentiation over the final analytic curve, which is just 300 seconds. And the last line Are you interested in the last line, Dan, or should I? What is this line? So this line is the statistics of number of points, and when they are divisible by 2, or by 4, or odd. So this is a kind of controversial issue. Should I force the number of points to be divisible by 4 any time, or not? And when you take a standard proof, then you have to authorize odd numbers sometimes. This is my opinion. But I will have to check this, because I tried to force divisibility by 4, and it always ended in catastrophe, like slowing down the program and so on. So, and you slow it down in the worst possible way, because you slow the first phase, which is already very slow. And the second may be improved a little bit, but not that much. Okay, so that's all. What's the conclusion of all this? Two different contexts, and if I heard correctly, when the crypto thing could be subdivided in more subcontexts, for instance, so to speak. So, if I had to redo that talk, it's clear that you cannot optimize the same part in ECPP and CM crypto at the same time. You need two sets of optimizations, depending on what you want in the end. So here it's optimized for primality proving, and probably not for crypto CM. New invariants, very useful, and very used. I'm still waiting for to be able to use any invariant I create, so to speak, in the CRT method. Okay. So these guys were too lazy. They are preparing talks and not solving this problem. So I'm just waiting. I'm patient. My program works. So you see, I decided a long time ago that my programs were mine, so that I'm not blocked by anyone. Otherwise, it will be a catastrophe. So some unsolved problem. I already mentioned that class number in batch. More faster route finding. I don't know. And yet, I have this problem to solve. I'm trying to solve it for. I've been trying to solve it for 20 years. I like to want my program live without me. And it's easy for kids. It's not easy for programs. And I don't know why. And maybe we should do the same thing. I don't know. Right. Maybe programs should marry or whatever. Maybe. Sage is kind of wedding. Anyway. Okay, and obviously, there are more references on my webpage about all this. And thank you for your attention. That's it. Yes.
If the bottleneck in your computation is all the CRP,
yes,
then the most obvious way to reduce that is reduce the number of steps, which means insisting on larger screen cards. How much would that slow down the other parts?
You mean like increasing that time here? I mean, you're fighting something that is inescapable. I mean, here it means that you extract small factors of less than 64 bits. Maybe. It's not the real case, but maybe. And what? I cannot go to 80. Okay. So, you see, I have to find small factors of larger and larger numbers. Okay. So, there's some help by this, but not so much. And asymptotically, no help. Okay. Just because factoring is too difficult. And so here is just, and after that you would have memory problems. But asymptotically I lose. So asymptotically this is a slow algorithm. But it depends on what big is anyway.
Any other questions? I have just one, a short one maybe.
Yes.
When you're trying to find the batch class number question you're asking,
yes,
how big is the set?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe like
several thousand. Several thousand and up to roughly that size.
yeah, something like this. So,
can I teach you 5 days?
Cumulative time, yeah. Because you have to do that. I mean, the set of D's depends on N. Okay? And so, each time you have a new N coming, so each time you start a new step, you have to rebuild a new set of D's. Okay, for small D's, it's in a file. Okay? So maybe, but what I do cannot cache is something, a D between, I don't know, from the top of my head, something like between 10 to the 8 and V. Okay? So, you see, the way fast TCPP works is that you have a pre-computed set of prime factors of your discriminant. Okay? You multiply them together to have good discriminants, and you want the class number of these guys. Because it's better to do this like this, because, I mean, I could just use a discriminant and then say, okay, I will compute the class number anyway. If you do that, you will end up with large class numbers, and also class numbers which are not smooth. And if your class number is not smooth, then you cannot decompose like Galois stuff, and you will slow down your second phase. Okay? So now I have this pre-computed set of primes, I build discriminants, and I want the class numbers of all these guys at the same time. And they depend on N. Okay? So I cannot reuse, generally, the preceding set to the new set. That's a good question. I could look at this, but intuitively, I mean, for N to split in a quadratic field, you have very strong arithmetical properties of N compared to D's. So from one end to another, the situation will change completely, or almost completely, I guess. And so maybe, as a final comment, yeah, maybe it could help that all discriminants are obtained by products of the small prime. I don't know. I'm not sure, but who knows? There are many more specialists here of class numbers. That's my idea.